Accession number 18022, Reel 2.
Ken Black, Reel 2.
They'd served such a long time in India prior to the Second World War. Nobody seemed to know of them and that. I mean, the thing was, when you saw your name up and which regiment you were going to, you immediately went and asked possibly one of NCOs, training NCOs, you know, what's this regiment, where are they, you know, various things like that. But nobody knew a great deal about 8th Hussars, and so within a couple of days, as I say, there were 40 odd of us, and we all left Catterick to go to Leicester, on Leicester East Airfield. It had been I don't know whether it was a bomber or a fighters, but it was an airfield at Leicester, but the RAF no longer used it, and the 8th Hussars had come back from Germany, and they were stationed on this airfield, and so we all went down to Leicester. We all went into A Squadron while they sorted it out. Excuse me, while they, you know, they sorted who went into what squadron, and quite a few of us stayed in A Squadron. It was very much under strength, and while we were while I was at Leicester, you did the second part of your course that you hadn't done at Catterick. If you were a driver operator, you did one part at Catterick and the other part when you got to your regiment. Well, I was was driver operator at first, and then they changed it round to signalman driver. So as I'd done the operator's course and passed, when I went to Leicester, I did the driver's course, and of course that was ideal for learning to drive. I'd never driven anything in my life, not even a motorbike, and I learnt to drive on about a 36-ton Comet tank, which were quite an experience. And there was plenty of land, you know, with it being an airfield and that. You didn't just learn to drive on the concrete, you learnt to drive on the, you know, the rougher terrain.
What was it like driving those types of tank?
Initially, when you got in them, personally, I was terrified of the damn thing. I mean, it was so big and probably not as big by today's standard, but when you'd never driven anything in your life, and it was a big gate change gearbox, and that, you know, you sat with it between your legs kind of thing, and it was all marked out, you know, first gear, second gear, third gear, fourth gear, and you had a little gate to lift up to put it in reverse, and it was a two-handed job. You know, not just like a car, you didn't just slip in nice and easy. It was like a kind of crash box, and you had to gauge the revs, or you had them screaming its head off, and that. It was certainly an eye opener. Like other things, towards the end of the course, it got a lot easier. I mean, you got more used to it.
What kind of a welcome did you get in the regiment?
I think they seemed pleased to see us, because they wanted the strength made back up again. Like with it being an airfield, you spent a lot of time marching up and down because of the distances between we were in Nissen huts, you know, little Nissen huts. An A Squadron was at the bottom near a wood, and it was about a quarter of an hour's march up to the cookhouse and back again after meals, and then after your breakfast you went up to the tank hangars, which was probably 25-30 minutes march up, and so you spent a lot of your time simply marching up and down between different periods of time, like. You had to gauge your time. If you were on guard and you were in A squadron, you had to allow yourself to, if guard mounting was 1800 hours, you had to allow yourself time to get up there before 1800 hours. It was some had bikes that they'd begged, borrowed and stolen and that, but if they had a bike, there was very rare. I mean, we couldn't afford to buy bikes, not on the money that we was earning.
And after your spell learning to drive the tank?
We came up to Whitby to put a moorland fire out. I believe it's still burning. It breaks out eventually every so often, this moorland fire, and the peat's that deep, it just smoulders under the ground. And they brought us up to a disused camp outside Whitby. They called it Selly Hill Camp. And they had a control radio there in a like a kind of porter cabin kind of thing. I don't know, they were a 3-ton alike. And it was fitted out with this radio. And the other guys, you did, what was it now, 12 hours on and 12 hours off, either there and on the radio and messing about during the day, or the other guys patrolled the roads in a Daimler armoured car. And if they saw a fire, you know, the outbreak of a fire, they called back into the camp, the message was passed on, and they would send two or three tonner loads of blokes out with shovels and picks trying to scratch it out at ground and that. And sometimes you, as I say, sometimes you were on the base radio, and then sometimes you got a cabbie out in the on the moors and that. We did that for about 4 weeks, and then we...
Was that the summertime?
That was towards the back end, because the first few days we were there, the nearest place was Whitby, which is obviously, you know, is a seaside place. But we'd only been there a couple of days, and the season finished. And when the season finished at Whitby, you've never seen such a dead one-horse town in all your life, or should I say, dead fish. There was nothing at all. There was a cinema, one show in a night. There was the pubs and that, but we couldn't afford the money to go drinking and that. And the food was terrible. Sometimes we'd fish three times a day. Kippers for breakfast. Boiled haddock or something like that for dinner, with the usually vegetables. And then fin and haddock for tea and that. It was so bad that the cookhouse was broke into. They stole eggs and beans and a frying pan.
Did this involve you?
No. No.
What happened after Whitby?
We came back to Leicester, not for very long, and then they made B Squadron at that time. While we were up at Whitby, B Squadron had gone to School of Infantry as demonstration battalion at Warminster. And they were short, so they took people out of A Squadron, and we went down to School of Infantry at Warminster as demonstration battalion. And that was brilliant. We'd come out of Nissen Huts and proper built, purpose-built barracks with central heating in, and you walked undercover from your rooms and that to the cookhouse. The cookhouse was in the centre. We were at one side in one wing, and the Lancashire Fusiliers were in the other wing. They were the demonstration infantry battalion. And your duties consisted of, you were taken up on the moors, and the officers from NATO used to come from all over the world to be shown armour and infantry tactics. And Imber Village, which they used, which was taken off the people during the war, was in a beautiful valley. And so there were stands and that on the valley. And it would, if you stood, if you were in the stands, you would see two or three tanks come up, or a troop of tanks come up and stop. Infantry had run round and that. And all of a sudden there would be an explosion and a smoke as though a tank would be hit. But there were markers and things in the ground, so that the commander knew to drive at the side of that and stop. And it were like a small charge that sappers had laid. And somewhere there were a guy that plunged it, and it, the smoke came up and, you know, a bit of an explosion, and everybody would bail out the tanks as though they'd been hit. And he took part in various these exercises. And if you got to see them from the actual stands where the officers were watching, they were brilliant. It really looked like the real thing. The village at that time was marked with A, B and C. And I've forgotten which way it worked. One building you could fire bullets at, another building you had to be very careful, and third, the other one, other category, you couldn't touch, because people still go back to Imber today twice a year for church services. Easter and I forgot what the other time is, because all the relations are still buried in Imber.
And what was it called?
Imber.
Where was it?
Wherever the School of Infantry, the nearest place was Warminster itself. That's right, yeah. I gather it's been expanded now over the years and that, and, you know, it's grown beyond proportion.
And this would be the winter time?
Getting on towards the winter time, autumnish winter time, yeah. Yes, it would. Yes, it would be getting on towards autumn time, yeah. Yeah, because it was while we were at School of Infantry, we heard rumours that the regiment was going abroad. You appreciate in those days, you know, we didn't have radios and newspapers. Well, there was newspapers, but, you know, nobody bought newspapers and that. And so the radio you used to listen to was if you went in Naffy at evening and that. And then it turned out then that we heard that 8th Hussars were going to Korea, which we didn't know where it was or anything about it. But this, we had to do conversion courses from Comets and Cromwells onto a Centurion Mark III. So they withdrew everybody from School of Infantry. I don't know who took over from us. And we all ended up down at Tidworth doing different you know, the drivers did the conversion course for the driving side of it. The gunners did the conversion course for the gunnery, but and the operators did the operating side. The radio was the same, but loading the gun was different. And so we went down to Lulworth Cove, and we went down there 3 days to do the conversion course, both gunners and operators. And we had 3 days down there, which we learnt to, you know, the gunner learnt the new techniques and that, because it was a much more superior tank was the Centurion Mark III. And it had a gyroscope and stabilizer, like a battleship. Once you laid the gun on, whichever way you turned the tank, the turret followed it round, you know, up and down. And so that all had to be learned. And basically, there wasn't much to change over for the operators, but it was a bigger shell, and the Beezer machine gun that the operator also had to do the stoppages on, and that was basically the same. And then we all came back to Tidworth, and we spent quite a while taking vehicles to different docks. Some of us, we didn't actually drive, the tanks went on a transporter, a tank transporter, which we didn't drive. The RASC drove the transporter, but they would drive them down to the docks, and we would drive them off the transporter and leave them on the docks ready to be loaded. We went to Southampton, some went to Barry in South Wales. A lot of the light-skinned vehicles came up to Liverpool to be loaded. So if you were a wagon driver or probably a Daimler driver, you would be coming up and down to Liverpool with vehicles, whereas we just ran to Southampton. Then they would bring us back again, then you would take some more until they'd all gone. At that time, we was also getting ready, issued different kit, issued with, three of us had jobs, a job one evening, stamping up identity discs for our squadron. We also got pump full of different needles and that, of various things, with vaccinations for smallpox and that. With taking vehicles down to docks and that, we'd missed a lot of these injections, and we thought we'd got away with it. We came back one Saturday, and they chivvied us all down to the MI room, and we'd four injections within a couple of minutes. And we went to the pictures that night, and we sat, arms folded like this. You didn't let anybody bang your arms, because they were so tender. And then we got the date to sail to Korea, and there was a pub, I believe it's still there in Tidworth, they called the Drum, and each squadron hired a room, and there was a monumental booze up. It was, never seen anything like it. And same as our Sergeant Major, which was, you know, he looked upon him as a demigod. We actually saw him drunk dancing on a table. Yeah, and I saw the same man I saw him in May this year down at Leicester. And then it was a case of on the train down to Southampton, and we sailed on the Fowey to Korea.
The Empire Fowey.
Empire Fowey, that's right, yeah. Yeah. While I was on the Empire Fowey, while we were sailing, we hadn't been on a couple of days, and one of the blokes out of the squadron, they came to me, and he said, "Hey, Blackie," he said, "there's a artillery corporal wants to see you." And, you know, he thought, artillery, what has he got to do with us? You know, I said, "Are you sure it's me?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "He asked for your name." So I went up onto this deck like, and this artillery corporal. I said, "Do you want to see me?" He said, "Yeah." He says, "Is your name Black?" I said, "Yeah, it is." Yeah, he said, "My name's Black as well." So I said, "Well, you know, fairly common name." So he said, "Have you got any grandparents?" I said, "Yeah, I have. I've got two lots of grandparents." He says, "One lives at Burton Salmon, which is just outside, well, it's a few miles outside Pontefract." "Oh, no, no," he says, that's not it then. He said, "Have you got any more grandparents?" I says, "Yeah," I said, "I've got two more, live at Harrogate." He says, "Do you know where they live?" I said, yeah, I said, "I went over to see them anyway a few weeks ago." He says, "Where do they live?" I said, 80 Albert Road, Bilton. He says, "That's funny." He says, "My grandparents live there too." And it was my father's brother's son, and I'd gone to see my grandparents first, and he'd gone to see him after. And we knew we were sailing on the Fowey, and I told him we were sailing on the Fowey. Then he turned up later on to say he was going, and he was sailing on the Fowey. And so I met him there, and I've never seen him since. My grandmother said that he got wounded and invalided back and invalided out. And they believe he's living in Canada but I never see him, never saw him since. So we palled about a bit together while we're on the boat.
What was the voyage like for you?
First few days, brilliant. Then for about 3 days, I was seasick. And if you've never been seasick, it is the most disastrous thing that can happen to you. If they'd picked you up and thrown you over the side, you wouldn't have given a toss. It was horrendous. We'd been in the right. They had a writing room, you know, and you could go and sit and write letters in there. And somebody brought some tea and biscuits in, so I'd had these tea and biscuits. And about 9:30, I think it was either 9 or 9:30, there were a ship's inspection, and the ship's captain used to come round with his, what is the word, entourage, and that, you know, inspecting the ship. And I was in the reading room, and I could feel this churning, and that. And I galloped down onto the mess deck, and I just made it to a basin. And I was sick in a basin, just as he happened to come in the toilets. And he said, "Been seasick, son?" I says, "Yes, sir, I had." I couldn't think of anything else to say. And it lasted for about 2 or 3 days. We laid on the deck, on the open deck, in the fresh air, and I don't think we had virtually nothing to eat. We just couldn't keep anything down. Orange juice, this stuffed us with orange juice. For 3 days, it was terrible. After that, brilliant. Never sick again.
Did you do any training aboard?
Yes, yeah. We did small arms training, first aid. We got lectures and, you know, courses on first aid. And that's about all we did, like.
Did you sail straight to Korea?
No, we stopped at Port Said, but they wouldn't allow us any short leave because the troubles were just starting. Then it went through the Suez. When the Fowey on that particular voyage was going through the Suez Canal, there's a bend in the Suez Canal. I think they call it Ishmaelia or something. And instead of negotiating the bend, it hit the canal. It ran up the canal. And they were right, panic about that. They eventually got it off themselves, and it stayed in the Bitter Lakes for 2 or 3 days while the divers went down to check any damage in that. But there was no damage, so we went further on to Aden. We got a bit of shore leave at Aden, a bit of shore leave at Colombo and Singapore, and then we went from Singapore straight to Korea. And after being seasick across the Bay of Biscay, when it left Singapore, it ran on the edge of a typhoon. And we sat on the decks watching a cinema show as the ship went up and down. No more seasickness after that. And then we, as I say, we arrived in Korea, which was an eye-opener, was that?
In what way?
We could smell it. It stunk rotten. And we had to stay an extra overnight on the ship because there'd been an outbreak of smallpox. And although we'd been vaccinated before we left UK for smallpox, we had to stay overnight on the ship while we had another smallpox vaccination. Then we got off the next morning. And there was a Yankee band to greet us in, all big, so I don't suppose you should use the word now, niggers, but coloured people, a brilliant band. Played St. Louis Blues, and not one of our, typical of one of our band, they played all popular tunes. If we knew you would come in, we'd have baked a cake and things like that, and they did all this counter-marching and that. Brilliant.
This is at Pusan, is it?
That was at Pusan, yeah. And then we offloaded onto big American wagons, like similar to articulators, but topless. And they took us to this, we call it Jap Camp. just outside Bassun. I couldn't exactly tell you where or when, you know, exactly where it was. And it was just I think a lot of the roof were missing, there were no windows in, and they were just cots set up side by side by side. And they had a cookout as well for cooking compo rations up. And we did a lot of physical training while we waited of the ships bringing the vehicles from UK, because the ships had set off before us, but with them being slow, they landed after us. And so as the ship started landing, you went down to the docks. And all the vehicles had been, especially the inside, breech blocks and things like that, had been covered in grease and that to stop this sea salt air rusting them. So they all had to be cleaned and that. And at that time, I got stuck on a Churchill, because the Centurions were so new, they hadn't got a Centurion recovery vehicle. So I got put on a Churchill as a recovery man, and that's what I did all my time in Korea, recovery. As the vehicles came in, they put us onto flat cars, you know, just flat bodied railway trucks and that, and these Koreans that loaded us on, they were driven on by the drivers, but these Koreans tied them on with straw ropes, tying a 52-ton tank, tied on with a straw rope. And we put the bivvies up at the back, and they trundled us off up to North Korea. And they had a railway carriage at the end, and we used to use the railway carriage for cooking. We slept on the flat cars at night with the vehicles and that. And then when it was breakfast time, you had to jump from flat car to flat car to get onto the carriage to get your breakfast. Can you just turn it off now a minute, please? I fell off the train in Korea. We were going up... The other thing, three of the crew was armed with a 38 pistol, and the driver had a Sten gun. And when they said, right, you're going up the front line, they were short of 38 ammunition, and they gave us 9 rounds, and you put 6 in a revolver, you know, like the cowboy's revolver, Smith & Wesson, and they issued us 9 rounds to go into action with. Anyway, we were going on up on the train, and it got to breakfast time, and the other guys had got up, and they said, well, we're going, we'll see you later, Blackie. So I said, yeah, okay. And I stopped in the sleeping bag a bit extra. I thought, well, I better go and get my breakfast now. So I got out sleeping bag, and you kept your clothes on, like all you did was take your boots off. And somehow, as I got one boot on, and as I was putting the other one on, I took a pace forward, you know, like to tie my lace, and I flopped off the railway carriage. Next thing I knew, I was laid on side at railway lines, and the train was disappearing up the line. And so I'm trying to run up after the train, and the carriage door opened at the back, and I'm waving my arms and shouting and one thing.